Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
Anybody ever had an encounter with Spencer prior to this in high school? Peter thinks he does.
I'm thinking not anymore.
Not anymore. Pardon me? You generally don't get to Spencer until fairly high up as an English major, so you all are getting an advanced glimpse of this. You know, it's like you've gone into a high level and you're playing against, you know, level 40s with your level 15 characters. Pardon me?
So we just get ganged with bought an account on eBay and going in there.
That is a great analogy. You have bought an account on eBay by getting in to Vanderbilt University. That already puts you up in the level 50 category, and now you're having to play, learn the game mechanism for this new world that you're in. Perfect analogy. So let me tell you a little bit about Spencer. Edmund Spencer, starting out, let me have your attention, close down your screens if you can't avoid being distracted from other things, because I'm going to lecture a little bit to give you some context for this poetry. Spencer was born, we think, around 1552. He was born of fairly humble parents, though he rose to be quite high in society by the end of his life, and he died in 1599. He went to grammar school, which a public school, as they called it, which was what we would call a private school in the United States, and then went on to Pembroke Hall in Cambridge, which is, you know, one of the finest educational institutions of the age. And he was extremely well-educated. Unlike Shakespeare, his near contemporary, a person that you are very likely to have read, Shakespeare was notoriously poorly educated. Spencer was highly educated and a master of all the fine arts of his period. What's the famous line about Shakespeare's education? He said, little Latin and less Greek. Well, Spencer was raised from a very early childhood. You go into these public schools, you're learning Latin and Greek from the age of 5 and 6 onwards, and he was completely fluent. In fact, most people of his group could read Latin easily, as comfortably as they could read English. This was a characteristic of the period, which we generally call the Renaissance. Some people are calling it the early modern era. They have changed to calling it the early modern era because they see it during this era the time when some of our modern attitudes towards the self and society were beginning to come into being. And so they want to claim for this period, the 16th century, a period of early modern times. But it's also often discussed in terms of Renaissance humanism. Do you have any familiarity with the term humanism in this era? Anyone aware of that term? What does it apply to you? Humanism. No? The evangelical movement in the United States loves to inveigh against the attitudes of secular humanists who believe in... Yes?
Isn't it a broad category of ethical philosophies that affirm the dignity and worth of all people based on the ability to determine right and wrong by appeal to universal human qualities, particularly rationality?
No.
Thought it might be close, though.
No, go with the Renaissance.
Renaissance humanism was a movement that affected the cultural, political, social, and literary landscape of Europe.
Yes.
It began in Florence.
Yes.
The last decades of the 14th century, I believe.
Yes.
It reviewed the study of Latin and Greek with the result of a revival of the study of science, philosophy, art, and poetry of classical antiquity.
That's getting closer.
Wasn't it based on the interpretation of Roman and Greek texts?
Indeed.
Whose emphasis upon art in the series marked a great change from the contemplation on the biblical values of humanity, introspection, and meekness?
It was, Chris.
Beauty was definitely held to represent a deep inner virtue and value.
Wait, what did?
Beauty.
Well, let's pause there. Beauty was definitely held. What kind of beauty? What kind of beauty?
Human beauty. Physical.
Human? Physical beauty? The body divine? What painters would you associate with the notion that the human body... You're not going to get it off of that screen because...
What?
Michelangelo. Indeed. The notion that the body itself was beautiful. What other kinds of beauty would we be celebrating? You've just read the first two cantos of a book of the Fairy Queen devoted to chastity. So what kind of beauty would be especially valued by Renaissance humanism?
Innocence.
Yes, innocent beauty, purity of beauty, untainted beauty, not sensual physical beauty, though physical beauty, in other words, physical beauty could be seen as a way to incarnate some of the highest principles of that we strive for. You know, if you switch from Michelangelo to Leonardo with his famous image of the human form divine as an image of perfection, so that the physical beauty could be a symbol for divine beauty very easily in this era. So, Chris, you're really very well educated on this subject. Could you go on telling us some of the things about it?
I might just quit while I'm ahead here.
Okay. So, we were asking what classical authors Spencer would have learned in school. And Chris did mention that he was very learned in certainly Homer, Greek writer. Yes.
Geoffrey Chaucer?
No, Chaucer is not what we mean by a classical author. Oh, classical in that sense is only Greek and Roman.
Homer.
Homer, definitely. Of course, in fact, Spencer did know Chaucer. But the English language poetry was regarded as the, you know, the no, just the vernacular literature, not the high classical literature. Yes. You can answer anyway.
Yes.
Other Latin and Greek works, that, authors that Spencer would be likely to be well versed in.
Plato, I think that's already been said.
Plato has not been said. You said it? Well, thank you. Plato, Homer. Yes.
Petrarch.
Petrarch would not be a classical writer. Petrarch, you know, Chris, I certainly appreciate your initiative and the depth of your learning, even though, you know, it's to be excused that someone who hasn't completed their education at Vanderbilt would not yet know how to pronounce Petrarch's name. The great 14th century Italian poet was not a classical writer, but an Italian Renaissance poet, and you notice that the Renaissance in Italy is there in 14th century. We're much later here in England. It took a much longer time for the Renaissance to get to England. But Petrarch was certainly a major influence on Spencer, particularly because of Petrarch's great sonnets to Laura and Petrarch's Petrarch's example of courtly love. Petrarch and Dante, the two Italian Renaissance writers, were models for courtly love as being a emblem, again, of all that humanity could aspire toward. Matt, you had something you wanted to contribute.
Was he also influenced by Virgil?
Well, yes. Thank you. That's so important. Virgil's, what great work did Virgil write?
Aeneid.
Aeneid. Well, but you're picking up on it now. This is called education, yeah. Virgil's Aeneid, but also his early works, the Eclogues, which were his pastoral poetry, and the Georgics, were models for Spenser. Spenser did write great pastoral poetry. He never wrote a Georgic, but he did write pastoral poems. And the Aeneid, which was the was Virgil's Latin epic that combined the virtues of both the Iliad and the Odyssey in one volume. Virgil is important, but another Latin author is really important. What
Catullus?
Ovid is it. Catullus, I doubt if he knew Catullus. That's a great suggestion. Catullus is a kind of scabrous, ribald poet. And of course he knew him, because he knew everything. Basically, at that time, to be as educated as Spenser was, it was before the explosion of learning, and you could basically have read everything.
The body of knowledge.
The body of knowledge. Unlike today. So, of course, he knew Catullus, but that's not nearly as important as Ovid. And Ovid is the author of what great work?
Metamorphosis.
Metamorphosis. That is like the bullfinch's mythology of the day, or, of course, maybe you all don't know what bullfinch's mythology is. At any rate, it's a compendium of all the great myths. And you see that throughout the Faerie Queene. Troping on, morphing, retelling, incorporating, alluding to Greek myths from Ovid, particularly the myths of things changing into other things, which is what the Metamorphoses are all about. And it's very erotic stuff, because the Greek gods had a little bit of difficulty keeping their pants on. That's right. Okay, that's probably enough. I mean, I just wanted to make the point to you that there is a continual reference between Ovid and Virgil in Spenser's poem to Ovid and Virgil. There's also a continual elusive level to Homer and Plato, which has already been mentioned, and something that hasn't been mentioned, Aesop's fables. You know, Aesop's fables, little children's stories, but about beasts and animals, you know, they're all through this. And then the Italian Renaissance writers, Petrarch, Boccaccio, and Dante, and the late, almost his contemporaries, Italian romance writers, Ariosto, who wrote a poem called Orlando Furioso in 1532, only about 60 years before Spenser's poem, and Tasso, Jerusalem Delivered in 1574. So, why is this important? Because I want to talk with you about what allegory meant to Spenser in the context of Renaissance humanism. What do you think of when you hear the word allegory?
Something that refers to something else.
Perfect. You just defined it. Something that refers to something else. It comes from the Greek word allos, that means another or different. So a word that means itself and something other, or different at the same time. But what do you think about? Not just how do you define it, but what do you think about when you hear of an allegory?
Allegory of the cave.
Pardon me? Allegory of the cave?
Think of Lord of the Rings. That's the first.
I see.
Or in Chronicles of Narnia.
Chronicles of Narnia would be a big
allegory.
We're used to thinking of allegory in terms of naive allegory, which has a kind of one-for-one correspondence between characters and some kind of abstract conceptual scheme, you know, very mechanical. I don't know if any of you all have ever read or even heard of Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. You have, but that's what I would call naive allegory, where you know, the hero is called Christian, and he goes to, he's trying to find the mountain of hope, and he gets lost in the slough of despond. Well, it's a very literal one-for-one correspondence. That has nothing to do with what allegory means to Spencer. I mean, for one thing, if you've read just a little bit of this book about chastity, and does it feel like a simple moral tale about chastity in the early going? What?
Well, it seems
like it does. It does.
I don't think it's pointed towards. I mean, I've not read a lot of stories about chastity, so I don't know.
Well, let me just talk to you about Spencer's understanding of allegory. For him, allegory was a way to have almost every image in the poem have multiple meanings, multiple planes of reference, often more than just one, you know, more than just two. That a character would not represent just the character and something else, but have a whole web of meanings, which is part of why all of this classical and learned allusion is important, that he is expecting his readers to be picking up on a whole range of references. And of course, the more you do pick up on those, the more you enjoy the poem. But Renaissance humanists learned to read allegorically from the practice of biblical exegesis, particularly from the habit of reading the Old Testament typologically as foreshadowing the New Testament. I should have put this up on here, and I didn't. Let's see. Typology and reading typologically. Typology is a method of exegesis, a method of critical interpretation that sees events in the Old Testament as antitypes, that is, before types. So that I should have said, let's just say, Old Testament events are antitypes of what?
All stories told afterwards.
Pardon?
Of all stories told afterwards.
Of all stories told afterwards, but particularly one story. Yes?
Christ.
Particularly Christ's life. So look at how odd that is. What an odd way to read. To take the story of a nation, a 1,000-year history, or more than 1,000 years, history of an entire people, and see each and every detail, every image, every character, every event, as foreshadowing something that one man did. And that's a bizarre way to read. And yet it was the dominant way to read, and still in many ways... Any Catholics or Episcopalians here? It doesn't matter which you are. In both those traditions, you have lessons. What are the lessons from?
The parables, you mean?
What are they from?
The New Testament. Some in the Old Testament, I'm sure.
Anyway,
me as well.
Every single Sunday in both those church traditions, you have a reading from the Old Testament and a reading from the New Testament. You may not have noticed, but those are always typologically linked. So that even today, every Sunday in Catholic and Episcopal services, you have that method of thinking about the universe put before you. So that you get an event from the Old Testament, then you get something that Jesus did from the New Testament, juxtaposed, and often the sermon will be about the connection. So that gave Spencer a method of thinking, but look at how he reversed it. He has a whole people that are the antitypes of Christ's life. That's the biblical exegesis. What this poem is a poem about... Maybe he didn't entirely reverse it. He says it's a poem about the education of Prince Arthur, the building of the ideal prince. So all these characters, all these events, all of these lands become antitypes of the ideal Prince Arthur. So that it really is, it becomes much harder to just start reading one for one. So that when you meet a character, you know automatically, oh, this is a good character, that means it has this meaning. That's an evil character, that means it has that meaning. It's very difficult to do that. Another reason that Renaissance humanists found this kind of allegorizing to be such a valuable tool was that think of what they were trying to promote. They were trying to promote Greek myth, Latin culture in a fairly religious climate. Well, the Greek and Latin literature that they had at their disposal is really salacious stuff. It is really inappropriate stuff for
salacious.
Salacious stuff. So, if in a way, the thinking saying everything is an allegory of Christ. And that Prince Arthur is in fact a Christian hero, allows you suddenly to have all this sensual pleasure in your poetry and say, but it's really an allegory of the perfect Christian prince. It's not a scandalous story about Malacasta trying to get in bed with Britomart. Okay. I think that may be enough about Renaissance humanism. But I wanted to give you I wanted to draw your attention here to a chart that I have created from reading Northrop Frye, who was one of the great critics of Spencer and of many writer of many of much literature. And what he wants us to understand is that everything in Spencer has a fourfold reference. That he wants you to think of the entire imaginative cosmos as existing on four levels. The highest level would be the order of grace or providence, the heavenly order. Next below that is the Garden of Eden, what Blake, a later writer, would call the human form divine, the symbol of it. And is a myth of the Golden Age or Arcadia, which is something that a number of us talked about in reference to your papers, because a number of you all actually quoted in your first paper a passage that included the word Arcadia. So Seth, you all remember having that conversation with me. Arcadia is a perfect golden land. And of course, Fairyland is Spencer's attempt to create a landscape of the Golden Age, of the myth of the Golden Age. The third level is the level of physical nature. Frye describes it as a world of brute forces, morally neutral, in the sense that a hurricane is morally neutral. It may cause a lot of damage, but it's not immoral. It's disastrous, but not immoral. Or the way a beautiful sunset is beautiful, but not moral. That kind of beauty on the Edenic level would be moral beauty and would have a kind of positive ideal value, whereas just sensual beauty on the earthly level is neither positive nor negative. It remains to be molded by our actions. Its chief symbol, according to Fry, is the cycle, or the cyclical, the four elements, like earth, air, fire, and water, the four seasons. And we, of course, are born into that physical world, and our struggle is to rise toward a redeemed human nature, to somehow to make ourselves types of the human form divine, or if we, failing that, sink towards the fourth lowest level, which is the underworld, the world of baser passions, of sin, sorrow, corruption, and death. And so these characters often have their actions can kind of often can be interpreted on all four of these levels as having references, having sort of meanings, coded meanings in each of these levels, so that you're getting way beyond a one-for-one correspondence between what a character means or even what a deed means. Now, Spencer, it turns out, was not much of a thinker. He wasn't a really strong conceptually. He certainly knew his philosophers. He knew his Plato and Aristotle. He knew his rhetoricians, his Cicero and Quintilian. But his genius lay not with abstract ideas, but with imagery. He's regarded as one of the greatest masters of the poetic image in the English language. A later great master of the poetic image, Keats, just worshiped Spencer. And Keats says, has everyone in here read some Keats in high school? You think so?
It sounds familiar.
No. Let's see how many have not think they have not read Keats. About half the class. Okay, well, Ode to the Western Wind is his buddy Shelley.
Okay.
Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn, Ode to a Nightingale.
Oh yeah, I've read.
Okay, we're getting more votes for Keats. Well, if you remember Keats, but still no to Tim. That's fine. I'm sorry. We'll try and bleep that out so your mother doesn't know you skipped the Keats assignment. Keats was a great sensual poet. He loved rich, vivid imagery, and he looked back to Spencer. And Spencer's verse form is designed to highlight the power of the image. It's a 9-line stanza. This stanza he made his own so completely that it's referred to as the Spencerian stanza. And the Spencerian stanza is a 9-line stanza in iambic pentameter. Maybe I'll save the Spencerian stanza until we get one in front of us, but we'll come back to the definition of the Spencerian stanza. We're drawing to the end of this contextual lecture here. Spencer intended to write a 12-book poem. He only ended up writing 6 books, but each of them is complete in itself, and the 6 books form a very complete pattern. Just as, and in George Lucas, who was directly imitating Spencer, and you can see it in hear it in his interviews, has a 6-part Star Wars. What do you call it? Initially trilogy,
epic.
2 trilogies, double trilogy. And he originally intended to write to make 12 movies. Yep, and he had the same experience that we think Spencer had. Spencer went, holy cow.
12 books.
And so everybody thinks that, in fact, this poem is complete in itself, that that it's not an incomplete poem, that he realized midway through that he had just better tie this baby off. The first three books, and it's up there on the board, are dedicated to holiness, temperance, and chastity. These are often thought of, are described, particularly by Northrop Frye, as private virtues, that they're virtues of the individual, that if you're a holy person, that's an individual character, but as it moves from 1 to 3, books 1 to 3, those virtues become more increasingly public, so that temperance involves your behavior in the external world. Now, holiness, you can just be a private monk in your cell and be holy. To be temperate, you have to, you know, be out there in the world and avoiding, say, excessive alcohol, excessive sex, whatever would be intemperate behavior. And chastity definitely is a public virtue. People also think of chastity, the first two, as being dialectically related, that holiness and temperance together leads to chastity. The books 4, 5, and 6 are very much public virtues. Friendship, justice, courtesy. Friendship, it takes at least two people. Justice refers to a whole social order, and generally a legal system is part of it. Yes, sir?
Are friendship and justice together courtesy?
Exactly. Think about that. Isn't that right? Friendship and justice is the courteous person. Courteous is a very important word to the Renaissance humanists, where it's not merely being polite to somebody. It's treating them with justice and human friendship or relationship. To put yourself in relation to another person is part of being courteous to them. So, I think that is probably enough. Let's turn to any questions about Spencer's background in this context for it. Then open up your fairy queen. Pardon me? It's opened. I reprinted for you, I believe, the Norton Anthology's description of the poem and the author's letter to Sir Walter Raleigh. So how many read the prefatory letter to Sir Walter Raleigh?
Was it the first part?
I started to.
It was the first part.
Second.
I said, I don't have to read this. I realized that wasn't...
Those of you that didn't read it, I would like you to go back to read it at the end of the three of the poem, not before. I'm actually kind of happy for those of you that did not read it. In retrospect, I wish I had assigned you to plunge straight into the poem, because...
That's what I was thinking.
Good, Daniel. Good. I'm really happy to hear that you
anticipate a lot.
It.
Yeah.
Right. The poem, in fact... I wish we could have skipped the prefatory 5 stanzas. The poem starts...
I read those and I was like, wait, those aren't the poem.
The poem really gets going in Canto 1, stanza 1. So, let's find a good passage to read. Who would like to read to us? Why don't we read?
I can pronounce Old English.
Pardon me?
I can pronounce Old English.
Well, this is not Old English. Let me disabuse you of that.
Chaucer.
Old English is Middle English. Yeah. Old English is as distant from us as German is. So that if this was Old English, you would not be able to read a single word of it unless you'd studied Old English. If this were Chaucer, it would be Middle English, and it would be considerably stranger than this. This is Renaissance modern English. He's a contemporary of Shakespeare. His language is a little more formal than Shakespeare's is, and consequently is a little lot more flowery and uses some stranger words than Shakespeare does. Shakespeare was trying to communicate on the stage in public. So why don't we remember we are going to be building a virtual world out of some of the events here. Why don't we read the first real encounter? The first real encounter. What's the first thing that happens in this poem that you think you could see occurring in an online game?
Britomart.
Yeah, getting owned by Britomart. Exactly. Okay. Well, that starts pretty early. It stands at 4. Who would like to read it?
Stanza 4.
Canto 1, stanza 4. Not the prefatory poem for book 3.
At last.
But at 690. Yes, Seth, you can.
Is this similar to Canterbury Tales?
It's not that much. Seth's already said it. He's already gone.
Okay,
try and read it. What I'd like you to do is to read it as close to modern English as you can while putting in those necessary extra syllables where they're called for.
Okay?
Go, Seth.
So, at last is through an open plain near the Yoda. They spied a knight that towards Prigged Pharaoh, and him beside an aged squire there rode up that seemed to...
Now, wait. No, just because it in Chaucer you would be go Yoda and Rhoda, but not in Spenser, unless there is this accent. It would be, at last, just through an open plain they yode, they spied a knight that towards. The reason there's an S on the British spelling of the word toward is that even today they put two syllables in that word, whereas good, honest Americans don't use an S. And
you say it, more,
you say it with one syllable. Towards Prigged Fair. Okay, go on.
And him beside an aged squire.
Aged squire, right.
That seemed to couch under his shield three square, as if that age bade him that burden spare, and yielded those that stouter could it wield. He then espying gan himself prepare, and on his arm addressed his goodly shield that bore a lion passing. In a golden field.
Okay, stop right there. So you what do you see that you're going to use in designing your this episode?
Lion on the shield. Lion shields, three portions.
Triangular, so you got a description there. Why do you think this knight stops and on his arm addressed his goodly shield and immediately gets ready? Mike, take the next stanza.
Which seeing good Sir Guyon, dear besought the Prince of Grace to let him run that turn. He granted, then the fairy quickly wrought his poignant spear and sharply gan to spurn his forty steed, whose fiery feet did burn the verdant grass as he thereon did tread. Nor did the other back his foot return, but fiercely forward came without dread and bent his dreadful spear against the other's head.
Going next?
Me.
Yeah, you were looking at it as though you were champing at the bit like Britomart's steed.
They being ye met, and both their points arrived, but Guillaume drove so furious and fell. That seemed both shield and plate it would have rived. Nathless, it bore his foe from his cell, but made him stagger as he were not well. But Guillaume's self, ere well he was aware, nigh a spear's length behind his crupper fell. Yet in his fall, so well himself he bare, that mischievous mischance his life and limbs did spare.
Next. Yep, next.
Great shame and sorrow of that fall he took, for never yet Sith warlike arms he bore, and shivering its spear in bloody field first shook, he found himself dishonored so sore. Gentlest knight that ever armor bore, let not thee grieve dismounted to have been, and brought to ground that never was before. For not thy fault, but secret power unseen, that spear enchanted was, which laid thee on the green.
Okay. What? Yeah. Game designer over there is thinking.
I just laid thee on the green.
What do you see in this? What do you see?
Mounted combat.
Mounted combat, clearly.
Weapons. About time.
About time. Seven whole stanzas in there before somebody's been knocked off his horse. What else do you see?
Enchanted
weapon. What is the enchantment on this weapon?
Doesn't kill people.
Knockdown.
Yeah, plus seven. probably stun. No doubt stun too. You know, knockdown and stun.
We're gonna lay it on.
Lay it on. So it's this enchanted spear, and it's in the weapon. So it's only when she equips that weapon that she has the. That she has that power.
Laid thee on the ground.
And what? Where does that power come from?
Chastity.
How'd you know? Because you're that smart. That's amazing.
He's a theater major.
He's a theater major. It comes from chastity. Her chastity has a kind of magical virtue, but unlike what you think, it's not armor. It's spear. How does that work? And here's a woman with a spear. How is that magically chased?
It's a defensive weapon.
I don't know. It sure did not Gian down.
But it didn't actually hurt him.
What I'm trying to drive at is that you can't. You got to think of. You got to look at the imagery and begin to interpret it in more complex ways, because. One, you know, our simplest understanding of chastity is as a defensive virtue. You know, that your armor's up, you're chaste, you can defend your honor.
But
right?
your power for chastity also comes from your willpower.
Exactly.
And
well
and
said.
Your
well
willpower
said.
Could be used for
best defense is a good offense.
Yeah, it's also true. But it also has a kind of power to do things in the world. In other words, to Spencer, this. Particularly, there's going to be all kinds of chastity and all kinds of lack of chastity in this story, in this book, I can tell you.
Yeah.
And Britomart's kind of chastity has power to do positive things in the world, not merely being a static or passive virtue. And so you get that right in the image, which is very contradictory. I mean, Spencer knows good and well that's a phallic image. Yeah. And there's going to be about 10 other phallic images in the very reading for today. So, you know, you'd have to be an idiot to think that Spencer didn't know that he was arming a woman with a phallic imagery to symbolize the magical power of her chastity to make changes in the world. It's a very interesting and more complex concept than virginity. Okay, next stanza, 8.
I'll go.
Yeah.
But weenest thou what rightly overthrew, much greater grief and shamefuller regret, for thy hard fortune than thou wouldst renew, that of a single damsel thou wert met. On equal plain there is so hard beset, even the famous Britomart was, in strange adventure, is that strange or strange?
Let's read it.
Okay. From Britain fet to seek her lover, love fair sought alas, whose image she had seen in Venus' looking glass.
Love far, I guess, sought alas. I'm not trying to correct you, but there's a meaning difference. She's been questing to find her love that she saw. So what's that stanza saying?
She's looking for her lover that she's
describing.
Yeah, but what about the first half of the stanza?
Got owned by a girl.
Got owned by a girl. Come on. You know?
Shameful.
That is, and Spencer means it that way. I mean, he's right there in the online multiplayer game world where that would be regarded as he says, you're just lucky you didn't know that it was a woman that puts you on your back. Nine. We're only going to read about four more, so who wants to go on nine? Yes, sir.
All right. Full of disdainful wrath, he fierce uprose, for to revenge that foul, reproachful shame, and snatching his bright sword, began to close with her on foot, and stoutly forward came. Die, rather, would he than endure the same. Which, when his palmer saw, he gan to fear his toward peril and untoward blame, which by that new recounter he should rear, for death sate on the point of that enchanted spear.
Anything you want to say about that?
But it's just, if he tries to fight her, then he'll die.
That's right.
I thought the point of the spear was that it didn't actually hurt people, though.
No.
No.
This is phallic power. This can wound and kill.
Right.
This book, I gotta say, I'm being laughed at here by my co-teacher in particular. This book is all about gender bending. And gender images and the meanings of gender, complex meanings of gender in the world and beyond the world in terms of salvation and the state. And it's a poem. Maybe we should pause since we're talking about gender. Who's the poem dedicated to?
The guy. It's a courtier. Is it a courtier novel?
It is a courtier novel to educate Prince Arthur.
Dude,
it's pretty much just.
But who's the poem for? Who's it in honor of? Who's it dedicated
to? Is it the person that pretty much is looking for?
That's Arthgal, who is a type of Arthur. You can even hear Arthgal as being a version of Arthur. Max?
Women, I guess.
Women? What woman in particular?
The Queen.
Queen Elizabeth. This whole poem is in honor of Queen Elizabeth. So, let's think about potent power of virginity, not merely as a passive virtue, but as a power to do things in the world. I didn't tell you enough about Spencer. I stopped midway. I didn't tell you that he became an employee of the state, so to speak, and was sent on a diplomatic mission to Ireland where he participated in, let me get my dates exactly right, he participated in 1580, a war in Ireland, where they decisively besieged, captured, and defeated a much larger Papist and Spanish force, which was there supporting the Irish in their rebellion against the Queen, and executed them all. So Spencer was a soldier poet. He'd seen it. When you talk about the stuff that we see, these besieging of castles, he's done it. When you see executing people, he's done it. And then, for his trouble, he was given 3,000 acres of Irish land for his estate, which is a nice little reward. And he basically spent much of his career in Ireland as either an envoy or a small governor of various places in Ireland. And he didn't publish The Fairy Queen, the first three books of The Fairy Queen, until 1590. And what occurred in 1588, is it? What occurred in 1588? There's a poem about it. There's a jingle, isn't there?
That's
what?
On the sea. You mean,
I'm really surprised that Chris, with his encyclopedic knowledge of Latin and Greek literature, doesn't also know what was big in 1580s.
Well, my encyclopedic knowledge.
Yeah, the Spanish Armada.
The burning of the ships.
Yes.
I just saw that movie, Elizabeth.
Well, I'm glad he
was in that movie.
In fact, we ought to have a field trip to see Elizabeth, the new version, when it comes out, as part of this.
Great music.
Is it? Have you seen the new Elizabeth?
Yeah, the one that just came out. That's what I'm saying. That's about
the 1580 Spanish Armada.
It's a little bit embellished.
The defeat of the Spanish Armada. So Spencer is a warrior. Wait, hold on. Attention. Give me your attention back. Spencer is a warrior, diplomat, poet, which is what is the ideal gentleman should be. All of those wrapped into one. He's seen it firsthand. He's publishing a poem in honor of Queen Elizabeth 2 years after the greatest military victory of the century.
This is equivalent of defeating Nazi Germany.
Exactly. So, you know, the people are hearing a political allegory. I just, you know, I didn't even put a political allegory up there. I put a kind of a cosmos, allegory of the cosmos, up there, but you could chart map on top of that a political and historical allegory, which is through here. So back to Britomart unhorsing poor Guyon in that stanza. It's Queen Elizabeth. Britomart is Queen Elizabeth among, but well, that's not true, because in the beginning of chapter 2,
the manifestation of virtues she
that's right.
possesses.
Nothing's one-to-one, exactly. And you would have wanted to correct me by turning right to the beginning of Canto 2. I assume you'd like to do that at this very moment. And see those first three stanzas that say, you know, I just can't do it. I'm not good enough to equal any of your virtues, Queen Elizabeth. Nothing I can write. Here have I cause in men just blame to find that in their proper praise too partial be, and not indifferent to womankind, to whom no share in arms and chivalry they do impart, nay, make in memory of their brave guests and prowess martial. Scarce do they spare to one or two or three room in their writs, yet the same writing small does all their deeds deface and dims their glories all. Same, you know, there's not enough women in history. But by record of antique times I find that woman wont in wars to bear most sway and to all great exploits themselves inclined, of which they still the garland bore away till envious men, fearing their rule's decay, gan coin straight laws to curb their liberty. Yet sith they warlike arms have laid away, they have excelled in arts and policy, that now we foolish men that praise gan eke to envy. You know, he's really laying it on thick.
He's pitching up bad.
He is really laying it on thick to Queen Elizabeth.
No wonder she got he got a pension out of it.
Right. But warlike puissance, of warlike puissance in ages spent, be thou, fair Britomart, who praise I write, but of all wisdom be thou precedent, O sovereign queen, whose praise I would indite I would, as duty doth excite, but ah, my rhymes too rude and rugged are, when in so high an object they do light, and striving fit to make, I fear do mar. Thyself thy praises tell, and make them known far. So, you know, he's just... So, you're absolutely right, Tim, to say that Britomart could not be, or maybe it was Seth that said, could not be a one-to-one correspondence with the Queen, not only because the whole poem has many characters in it that have facets of her virtues, but also because Spencer's not good enough to devise an image that would equal the radiance of Queen Elizabeth, who, when she does appear as a voice in the poem, is named Gloriana. So, okay, that's go back to where we were.
Professor Stanza, Clayton, yes. Question. Do you think he fancied himself or identified with the Red Cross Knight then?
Why do you ask the question? I think Red Cross is clearly more Spencer's hero. Red Cross Knight is the hero of Book One, and is much a protagonist of the poem. There just is no single protagonist in this. There's a lot of actors. That's why I chose this rather than a poem like Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. I wanted a multiplayer romance. And it's like Lord of the Rings, or rather Lord of the Rings is like Spencer, in that there's not just one or two characters, and even if you're concentrating on the Fellowship, there's Radagast the Brown and other players off scene doing important things. And that's much in the spirit of the Renaissance romance. Yes?
I was just going to ask, so who are we going to have the player play as?
Much to be debated.
The replayable characters.
That's what I would have thought.
So far, Littimart's a hero.
If we're talking about Red Cross being also like a big friend.
Yeah, we can have multiple characters, though.
But, like, don't they have to interact in certain ways to follow the story?
It depends on how.
Well, it depends on who you choose, which
right. Did you hear what Will said? So, what's a perfect example of making the wrong choice, but are following a dead end trail that could lead from a choice? So, say you're doing an escort quest, and you're escorting, say, Britomart, who's joined up with Gion and. Prince Arthur. What's the first forking in the road where a player? So say you're just have your player character that you've brought into the game. What's the first fork?
Well, you don't follow Arthur and Gion because they're going to chase off.
Gion are going to chase off out of the book after the forester. But I clearly think we ought to design a quest line.
Chasing
the Forester. And in fact, in Book 4 of the Fairy Queen, we find out what happens to Arthur and Prince Arthur and Gion when they run that Forester to ground.
Once you finish the quest, you have like a cutscene where you're waking up as Britomart and change characters. That would be cool.
Now you're thinking. Yeah,
Everyone else might know this, and I just might have missed it, but are we doing it on all six books, or just on three?
Just on book three.
So we're not
and not even back. All of book three. Okay. We're not even reading all of book three. The reading you have is an abridgment of book three. And we're clearly only going to be able to make two or three quest arcs from book three. What'd you ask?
Is that canto? Is that like one-to-one cantos? Quest lines?
No, I think quest lines may often go over more than one canto.
We're going to have a deep conversation over a series of weeks on game design and how we're going to remediate this. The important thing that we keep our focus on over the next couple class sessions is the content, understanding this content. From that trail and all the artifacts and people we're going to discover, we're going to have these design decision conversations, which Professor Clayton and I have already started, and we don't have answers to these questions. We're going to put them to the group. But it's going to be challenging.
Well, we're clearly not like physically designing the game, right?
Yes, we are.
But I have no idea how to write code.
But
what?
We're using the tool set.
It was all on you.
No, it's
using the tool set.
Place character here. Walls this big, expand. So it's okay, almost like writing a dungeon map.
But you can still like do scripting and whatnot.
Like triggers and stuff.
So we are going to be doing. We are going to be writing this code. Professor Hall is going to do 99% of it, but he is really eager to have help from anybody that wants to help. But everyone in class is going to work.
When are we going to be able to make
trial there on the syllabus?
So we can do it. But I thought we were doing it as like groups.
We are.
We are, and we'll describe the mechanics of that. Like I said,
once we get through Spencer.
Once we get through Spencer, but I thought
this digression was worth pursuing, much as Guion thought it was worth pursuing the Forester, because rude though it was, like the rude Forester, it brought to the fore how you ought to be reading this book. You ought to keep a notebook with a running column on the left, you know, saying each character you meet, what stanzas have descriptions, because you're going to have to go back into the poem when your group is assigned to develop a story arc for, say, pursuing the Forester. You're going to have to go back into the poem and find out what things looked like, what they did, and then, since they run off stage left, you're going to have to imagine what happens when they catch up with that guy. And Fair Florimel, one of the true heartthrobs of Book 3. And you'll meet her again, too. There are a lot of heartthrobs in Book 3, by the way. You've just barely scratched the surface with Britomart. We have a few more minutes. I want to finish. What about Malacasta? Let's read on. Have we read? No, we haven't read stanza 10. I'm going to read these last three stanzas and get done with this entire little story arc here. And hasting towards him, gan fair persuade not to provoke misfortune, nor to wean his spear's default to mend with cruel blade. For by his mighty science he had seen the secret virtue of that weapon keen. So he has a power to see that. He has the power to see the enchantments on other people's weapon. That mortal puissance might not withstand. Nothing on earth might always happy been. Great hazard were it an adventure fond to loose long-gotten honor with one evil hand. By such good means he him discounseled from prosecuting his revenging rage, and eke the prince, like treaty handled, his wrathful will with reason to assuage. Now listen to Prince Arthur here. And laid the blame not to his carriage, but to his starting steed that swerved aside, and to the ill purveyance of his page that had his furnitures not firmly tied, so is his angry courage fairly pacified. So what does Prince Arthur do?
Duke can rationalize. He's
blaming other people.
Yeah. And yet he is a gentleman of fair courtesy. How does that come about? You gotta,
it's perfectly acceptable to blame those beneath you.
Exactly. Yes. It's perfectly acceptable in that society to blame those beneath you. And a man, a knight's honor, think about this, a knight's honor is more important than the truth. You begin to get a little different worldview here. And it's supposedly a poem about Christianity, but you got to begin to think into a different worldview where not humiliating Guion was more important than telling the truth. And Prince Arthur is not then regarded as an unworthy knight. Okay, last stanza. Thus reconcilement was between them knit through goodly temperance and affection chaste, that is, Guion and Britomart. And either vowed with all their power and wit to let not others' honor be defaced, or friend or foe, whoever it embased, nor arms to bear against the other side. What'd they just say? I'm not going to do... What did Brit and Mart essentially pledge not to do vis-a-vis Guillaume?
To hurt you.
What? Not to attack him. What else?
Not hurt each other.
Yeah, they're not. She's not going to tell him that.
She's not going to tell anybody. She's not going to vaunt. She's not going to do a little dance over him. She's not going to. What did they used to call it when they those
taunts?
Taunt. Yeah, but Those jerks in DAOC were always bad at that. There was some word we have it for.
Oh.
Where you...
After well, PvP death,
when someone dies and you like go
mock them,
you stand over their body.
Yeah,
and
yes.
You're down camping. I can hail.
Well, okay, but at any rate,
that's the idea.
She's not going to do it. In which accord the prince was also placed? Three last lines here. In which accord the prince was also placed, and with that golden chain of concord tied, so goodly all agreed, and forth he fared did ride. Perfect little narrative scenario right there. We'll stop the class right there. Now, read carefully the assignment for next week. It's on the, I mean, for next class period. It's on the syllabus. I believe it's books, cantos 3-7. It's actually shorter because of the abridgment than today's reading. Or 3-6, I don't know. It's on the syllabus.
Golden chain.